I know how close you are to those people, but you've got to go up there and make the Mukhtar understand. Ari got up and walked away. I'll have to talk to Taha. David picked up the dispatches from Ari's desk, scanned them, and dropped them. He paced beside Ari, then stood looking out of the window in the direction of Jerusalem. A wave of moroseness washed over him. Ari slapped him on the shoulder. It will work out. David shook his head slowly.
Things are getting desperate in Jerusalem, he said in a doleful monotone. The convoys are having more and more trouble getting through. If this keeps up, they will be starving in another few weeks.
Ari knew how the siege of his beloved city was affecting David. You want to go to Jerusalem, don't you?
Yes, David said, but I don't want to let you down.
If you must, of course I'll relieve you.
Thanks, Ari. Will you be able to manage?
Sure. As soon as this damn leg stops acting up. See here, David. I don't want you to leave.
I'll stay until you are fit.
Thanks. By the way, how long since you've seen your Donna?
Weeks.
Why don't you go up to Gandafna tomorrow and look over the situation? Stay up there a few days and take a real good look.
David smiled.
You have such a nice way of persuasion.
There was a knock on the door of Kitty's office.
Come in, she said.
Yordana Ben Canaan entered.
I would like a word with you if you're not too busy, Mrs. Fremont.
Very well.
David Ben-Ami is going to come up and inspect the defenses this morning. We would like to have a staff meeting afterwards.
I'll be there, Kitty said.
Mrs. Fremont, I want to speak to you before the meeting. As you know, I am the commander here, and in the future you and I will have to work in close cooperation. I wish to express the opinion that I have complete confidence in you. In fact, I consider it fortunate for Gandafna that you are here.
Kitty looked at Yordana curiously.
I believe, Yordana continued, that it would be good for the morale of the entire village if we set our personal feelings aside. I believe you are right. Good. I'm glad we have an understanding. Yordana, just what is our situation here? We are not in too much immediate danger. Of course, we will all feel better about things when Fort Esther is turned over to the Haganah. Suppose something goes wrong and the Arabs get Fort Esther, and suppose the road through Abu Yeshah is closed. Then the prospects become very unpleasant.
Kitty arose and paced the room slowly.
Please understand that I don't want to interfere in military matters. But looking at it realistically, we may fall under siege. There is that possibility, Yordana said. We have many babies here. Can't we talk over plans to evacuate them and some of the younger children? Where shall we evacuate them to?
I don't know.
A safer kibbutz or moshav? I don't know either, Mrs. Fremont. A safer kibbutz is merely a term of relativity. Palestine is less than 50 miles wide. We have no safe kibbutz. New settlements are falling under siege every day. Then perhaps we can get them to the cities. Jerusalem is almost cut off. The fighting in Haifa and between Tel Aviv and Jaffa is the most severe in Palestine. Then, there is no place?
Yordana did not answer. She did not have to. Chapter 3 Christmas Eve, 1947. The ground was sticky with mud, and the air was crisp, and the first snow of the winter floated down on Gandafna. Kitty walked quickly over the green toward the lane of cottages,
Her breath formed little clouds.
Shalom, Gevert Kitty,
Dr. Lieberman called.
Shalom, Doctor.
She raced up the steps and into the cottage, where it was warm and Karen had a steaming cup of tea waiting.
Ugh, Kitty said. It's freezing outside.
The room was cheerful. Karen had decorated it with pine cones, ribbons, and imagination. She had even got permission to cut down one of the precious little trees, which she had filled with tufts of raw cotton and paper cutouts. Kitty sat down on the bed, kicked off her shoes, and put on a pair of fur-lined slippers. The tea tasted wonderful. Karen stood by the picture window and watched the snow fall.
I think that the first snow falling is the most beautiful thing in the world, Karen said.
You won't think it's so beautiful if the fuel ration gets any worse.
I've been thinking about Copenhagen and the Hansens all day. Christmas in Denmark is a wonderful thing. Did you see the package they sent me?
Kitty walked up to the girl, put her arm around her shoulders, and bussed her cheek.
Christmas makes people nostalgic. Are you terribly lonesome, Kitty? Since Tom and Sandra died, Christmas has been something I wanted to forget. Until now. I hope you are happy, Kitty. I am. In a different way. I have learned that it's impossible to be a Christian without being a Jew in spirit. Karen, I've done things all my life to justify something missing in myself. I feel, for the first time, that I am able to give without reservation or hope of compensation. Do you know something? I can't ever tell the others because they wouldn't understand. But I feel very close to Jesus here, Karen said. So do I, dear.
Karen looked at her watch and sighed.
I must eat early. I have guard duty tonight. Bundle up. It's very cold outside. I'll work on some reports and wait up for you.
Karen changed into bulky, warm clothing. Kitty knotted the girl's hair and held it in place while she put on the brown stocking-like Palmach cap so that it covered her ears. Suddenly there came a sound of voices singing from outside.
What on earth is that?
Kitty asked.
It is for you, Karen smiled. They have been practicing in secret for 2 weeks.
Kitty walked to the window. 50 of her children stood outside the cottage, holding candles in their hands, singing a Christmas carol. Kitty put on her coat and walked out on the porch with Karen. Behind the children, she could see the lights of the valley settlements over 2,000 feet below. One by one, the cottage doors opened with curious onlookers. She did not understand the words, but the melody was very old.
Merry Christmas, Kitty,
Karen said. Tears fell down Kitty's cheek.
I never thought I would live to hear Silent Night sung in Hebrew. This is the most beautiful Christmas present I have ever had.
Karen was assigned to a post in the outer trenches beyond Gandafna's gates. She walked out of the village and down the road to a point where the earthworks commanded a view of the valley floor.
Halt!
She stopped.
Who is there?
Karen Clement.
What is the password?
Chag Sameach.
Karen relieved the guard, jumped down in the trench, put a clip of bullets into the chamber of the rifle, closed the bolt, and put on her mittens. It was nice standing guard, Karen thought. She looked through the tangle of barbed wire toward Abu Yashah. It was nice being alone out here with nothing to do but think for 4 hours and look down on the Hula Valley. Karen could hear the faint voices of the children floating over the quiet winter air from Kitty's cottage. It was a most wonderful, wonderful Christmas. Soon the voices were still, and it was very silent all about. The snowfall thickened, building a white carpet over the mountainside. Karen heard movement in the trees behind her. She turned quietly and squinted in the darkness. She sensed something alive moving about. She froze and watched. Yes. Something was there in the trees. A shadow. Perhaps it is a hungry jackal, she thought. Karen flicked the safety catch off her rifle, put it to her shoulder, and sighted it. The shadow moved closer.
Halt!
Her voice snapped out. The figure stopped.
What is the password?
Karen! A voice called out.
Dove!
She climbed from the trench and ran through the snow toward him, and he ran toward her, and they fell into each other's arms.
Dove! Dove! I can't believe it is you!
They jumped down into the trench together, and she strained in the darkness to make out his face.
Dove, I don't know what to say.
I got here an hour ago, he said. I waited outside your cottage until you left for guard duty. Then I followed you here.
Karen looked around, startled.
It isn't safe. You'll have to hide from the British.
It's all right now, Karen. It's all right. The British can't hurt me anymore.
Her fingers trembled as she felt him in the darkness.
Dove, you're cold. You haven't even a sweater on. You must be freezing.
No. No, I'm fine.
The snow fell into the trench, and suddenly the moon appeared and they could see each other.
I've been hiding at the caves outside Mishmar.
I know.
I thought you were in America.
We couldn't go.
I guess you wonder what I'm doing here. Karen, I want to come back to Gandafna, but I took some watches and rings when I left, and I guess they think I'm a thief.
Oh, no, Dove. As long as you are safe and alive, that is all that matters.
You'll see. I'll pay everyone back. It doesn't matter. No one is angry with you.
Dove sat in the trench and lowered his head.
All the time I was in the Akko prison, and all the time I was in the caves, I thought to myself. I thought, Dove, no one is mad at you. It's just Dove that's mad. Mad at himself. When I saw you in Akko, I said, I didn't want to die anymore. I didn't want to die, and I didn't want to kill anyone. Oh, Dove. Karen, I never really had another girl. I just said that to make you go away. I know. Did you really know it all along? I made myself believe that, Dove, because I wanted to believe you cared for me. That is what is so wonderful about you, Karen. You can make yourself believe things, and make me believe them too. I wanted to come back to Gandafna and make you proud of me. I wanted to make you proud even though I thought you would be gone.
Karen lowered her eyes.
I'll do anything for you,
he whispered. She reached up and touched his cheek.
Dove, you are so cold. Please go to my cottage. You can tell Kitty everything. She understands about us. Just as soon as I get off guard duty, we will go see Dr. Lieberman together. Be careful. The password is Happy Holiday. Karen, I have thought so much about you all the time. I won't ever do anything wrong, or anything that would hurt you. I know that. Could I kiss you? Yes.
Their lips brushed with a frightened searching.
I love you, Karen,
Dove said, and ran off toward the gates of Gandafna.
International law, Barak Ben-Kanan said angrily to the United States delegate, is that thing which the evil ignore and the righteous refuse to enforce.
Conversation, no matter how well put, made little difference any longer. If the Jews declared their independence on May 15th, they would have to face 7 Arab armies alone. Kawukji's irregulars and the Palestine Arabs under the command of Safwat and Kadar increased their activities. The year 1948, the year of decision, came into being. Through the first few months, the Arabs became bolder and the tempo of the fighting increased as the British dismantled their huge military establishment and pulled back from position after position. The Galilee. Irregulars lay siege to Kibbutz Manara, high in the hills on the Lebanese border. A half dozen other isolated Jewish positions were cut off. The Arabs launched 5 straight attacks on Ain Zetim, the Fountain of the Olives, but each attack was beaten back. Syrian villagers began to fight. They crossed the Palestine border and attacked the northern Jewish outpost settlements of Kibbutz Dan and Kfar Zold. Major Hawks, the British commander, dispatched forces to help drive the Syrians back over the border. Arabs from Ata, helped again by Syrian villagers and irregulars, attacked Lahavot HaBashan, the Flames of the Bashan, mountains. Ramat Naphtali, named for one of the tribes of ancient Israel, was hit. Arab activity in Sfat increased as the Arabs waited for Major Hawks to withdraw. The blockade against the Jews was beginning to tell as food and water shortages developed in the Kabbalist city. Convoys were getting through to Jewish quarters only when the British helped. Haifa. The key port of Palestine was a major objective of both sides. For the time, the dock area stayed in British hands, as it was essential for British withdrawal. In Haifa, the Jews had one of their few superior positions in Palestine, in Har HaCarmel above the Arab sector. The British commander, openly pro-Arab, continued to force the Jews out of strategic positions they had won. Maccabees rolled barrel bombs down the slopes of Carmel into the Arab area, and the Jews managed to ambush a huge Arab arms convoy from Lebanon and kill the Arab commander. All normal business between the two sectors ceased. Amin Azadin, an officer of the Arab Legion, arrived to assume command of the ever-increasing irregular force. The British held the Jews in check to allow the Arabs to build enough strength to launch an attack up Har HaCarmel. The Sharon. This central plain, scene of the great Crusader battles, was the most thickly settled Jewish area. It faced the most heavily populated Arab area of Samaria, known from its shape as the Triangle. Although both sides remained poised, this sector remained relatively quiet. Tel Aviv-Yaffa. A battlefield appeared between the adjoining cities. Street fighting and patrols continued around the clock. The Maccabees took their place in the center of the Haganah lines. Raids on both sides were constant. The Arabs used a minaret as an observation and sniping post, and the position of the intervening British troops prevented the Jews from attacking it. The South. In the sprawling Negev desert, the Jewish settlements were few and widely separated. The Arabs had 2 large bases, Beersheba and Gaza, of the fame of Samson. The Arabs were able to put a deadly siege on the settlements and slowly starve them. Each Jewish settlement managed to hold, but the Arabs were bold in this area and the pressure steadily increased. The Jewish Air Force was born. It consisted of 2 Piper Cubs for liaison contact. Another Piper Cub flew into besieged Jerusalem. These Pipers carried out their first bombing missions by throwing grenades out of their windows. Jerusalem. Abdul Qadar tightened his grip on the throat of Jewish Jerusalem. The Bab el-Wad, that tortuous and vulnerable road through the Judean hills, was shut tight. The Jews were able to get through only by organizing large convoys and then at a heavy price. The British steadfastly refused to keep the roads open. Outside of Jerusalem, to the south, the Jews had four isolated settlements in the Hebron Hills on the road to Bethlehem. These four settlements, manned by Orthodox Jews, were known as the Etzion group. Their position was as bad and vulnerable as Sfat's. The Etzion group was completely shut off from Jewish Palestine. To make matters worse, the Transjordan Arab Legion, under the thin disguise of being British troops, blocked the road from Jerusalem to these settlements. Inside Jerusalem, the food and water shortages had become critical. Bombings, sniping, armored car travel, and open warfare were the order of the day. The fury reached a peak when a Red Cross convoy from the Hadassah Medical Center on Mount Scopus was ambushed by the Arabs, and 77 unarmed Jewish doctors were massacred and their bodies hacked to pieces. Again, British troops took no action. Zev Gilboa reported to Ari's office for the task of receiving Fort Esther from the British.
"We are all ready to go," Zev said. "Good. You may as well drive on up to the fort. Major Hawks said he would turn the place over at 1400. Say, what's this I hear about you and Leora having another baby?" "That's right. I'll have to stop giving you weekends off if you can't keep out of trouble."
Ari smiled. Zev ran outside, jumped into the cab of the truck, kicked off the brakes, and drove out of Ein Ohr Kibbutz. 20 Palmach boys and girls rode along to man Fort Esther. Zev drove over the main artery and then took the mountain roads toward the Lebanese border and Fort Esther. Zev thought about his last visit to his kibbutz, Ste Shimshon, the field of Samson. Leora had told him that they were expecting another child. What wonderful news! Zev was a shepherd when he wasn't on duty, but that seemed long ago. How grand it would be to take his sons out with him and laze on the hillsides around, watching the flock. He switched off thoughts like these. There was much work to do. When Fort Esther was turned over, he had to relieve the siege of Kibbutz Manara and start dispatching patrols along the border to cut down the flow of irregulars. The big concrete blockhouse dominated the entire Hula Valley. It would certainly be a relief to raise the Star of David over the fort. The gang in the back began to sing as the truck spun around the sharp turns on the mountain road. Zev checked his watch. It was 15 minutes until the appointed time. He turned the truck around the last turn. The huge square building appeared on the horizon a few miles away. Below him, Zev could see the white cluster of Abu Yesha in the saddle of the hill and the green plateau of Gandafna above it. As he drove within a few hundred yards of Fort Esther, he sensed something strange. He slowed down and looked out of the window. If the British were withdrawing, it was odd that there was no activity about. Zev looked up to the concrete watch and gun tower. His eye caught the flag of Kawukji's irregulars on the tower just as a burst of gunfire erupted from Fort Esther. Zev slammed on the brakes and pulled over to the side of the road.
"Scatter!"
His troops dived for cover. The truck went up in flames. Zev quickly pulled his people back out of firing range, assembled, and began to double time down the mountain toward Ein Ohr. When Ari received the news that Fort Esther had been turned over to the Arabs, he rushed to Sfat immediately, to the Taggart Fort on Mount Canaan. He went directly into the office of the British area commander, Major Hawks, a heavyset man with dark features. Hawks was haggard from lack of sleep when the angry Ben Canaan entered.
"You Judas," Ari snarled.
"It wasn't my fault," Hawks said in a half whine. "You've got to believe me."
"No, I can't believe it. Not from you."
Hawks held his head in his hands. "Last night at 10 o'clock I got a call from headquarters in Jerusalem. They ordered me to pull my men out of Fort Esther immediately."
"You could have warned me."
"I couldn't," Hawks mumbled. "I couldn't. I'm still a soldier, Ben Canaan. I didn't sleep all night.
This morning I called Jerusalem and begged them to let me go back to Fort Esther and take it back.
Ari glared at the man in contempt.
Whatever you think of me is probably right.
Ari continued to stare.
All right, have it your way. There was no excuse.
It's your life, Hawks. I guess you're not the first soldier who swallowed his conscience.
What's the use of talking? What's done is done.
This may make you a good soldier, Hawks, but I feel sorry for you. You're the one who has to live with the siege of Gandafna on his conscience, provided you've still got one.
Hawks turned pale.
You're not going to leave those children on the mountain. You've got to take them away.
You should have thought about that. Without Fort Esther, we've got to hold Gandafna or lose the whole Hula Valley.
Look, Ari, I'll convoy the children to safety.
They have no place to go.
Ari watched Hawks beat his fists on the table and mumble under his breath. He had turned Gandafna into a suicide position. There was no use of berating him further. The man was obviously sick over what he had been forced to do. On his way over, Ari's brain had been busy on a scheme, risky at best, but a long gamble that might save the key position of Gandafna. He leaned over Hawks's desk.
I'm going to give you a chance to undo part of the damage.
What can I do now, Ben-Kanan?
As area commander, it is completely within your rights to come up to Gandafna and advise us to evacuate.
Yes, but...
Then do it. Go up to Gandafna tomorrow and take 50 trucks up with you. Put armor in front and behind you. If anyone asks you what you are doing, tell them you intend to evacuate the children.
I don't understand. Are you going to evacuate?
No, but you leave the rest to me. You just come up with the convoy.
Hawks did not press to know what Ari had in mind. He followed the instructions and took a 50-lorry convoy to Gandafna, escorted by half-tracks and armored cars. The half-mile-long procession moved from the Taggart Fort through 6 Arab villages on the way to the Hula. It drove up the mountain road, through Abu Yashar, in plain sight of the irregulars in Fort Esther. The convoy arrived around noon at Gandafna. Major Hawks went through the motions of advising Dr. Lieberman to quit the place. The latter, on Ari's advice, officially refused. After lunch, the convoy left Gandafna and returned to its base in Swat. In the meanwhile, Ari confided to some of his Arab friends at Abu Yashar that Major Hawks had left tons of arms, from machine guns to mortars, at the village.
After all, Ari said in greatest confidence, Hawks has been a known friend of the Jews, and he was privately doing something to compensate for the Arab occupation of Fort Esther.
The story was planted. Within hours, the rumor had spread throughout the area that Gandafna was impregnable. The children were armed to the teeth. This story was lent weight by the fact that there was no evacuation of the children. The Arabs knew the Jews would get the children out if there were great danger. Ari made a visit to Abu Yashar once the might of Gandafna had been established and proved a checkmate. He went to see his old friend Taha the Mukhtar in the stone house by the stream. No matter how strained feelings were, a man must be made welcome in the house of an Arab. It was an age-old custom, but despite Taha's going through the motions of hospitality, Ari felt a coldness he had never known before from Taha. The two men shared a meal and spoke small talk. When Ari felt that enough ceremony had been served, he turned to the purpose of his visit.
"The time has come," Ari said, "that I must know your feelings."
"My feelings these days are of little concern."
"I am afraid that I must talk now as the Haganah commander of the area, Taha."
"I gave you my word that Abu Yashar would remain neutral."
Ari stood up from the table and looked Taha directly in the eye and spoke words harsh to an Arab ear.
"You have given your word, but you have broken it," he said.
Taha looked at him with a flash of anger.
We happen to know that Kawukji's men have been passing through Abu Yasha in droves.
And what do you expect of me?
Taha snapped.
Shall I ask them to please stop coming? I didn't invite them.
Neither did I. Look, my friend, there was once a time when you and I didn't speak to each other this way.
Times change, Ari.
Ari walked to the window and looked out at the mosque by the opposite side of the stream.
I have always loved this spot. We knew many happy days in this room and by that stream. Do you remember the nights that you and I camped out there? That was a long time ago. Maybe I've got a long memory. We used to talk about it during the riots, how ridiculous it was for everyone else to fight. We took blood vows to be eternal brothers. Taha, I was up all of last night thinking of what I was going to say today. I began remembering all the things that you and I have done together.
Sentimentality does not become you, Ari.
Neither does having to threaten you. Mohammed Kasi and the men in Fort Esther are the same kind of men who murdered your father while he was kneeling at prayer. The minute the British leave the area, he's going to come down from Fort Esther and get you to block the road to Gandafna. If you let him, he'll shove rifles in the hands of your people and order you to attack Yad El.
And just what do you expect of me?
And what do you expect of me? Ari countered.
A stony silence ensued.
You are the Mukhtar of Abu Yasha. You can rally your people just as your father did. You've got to stop doing business with the irregulars.
Or what?
Or you will be treated as an enemy. Or what, Ari? You are going to bring on the destruction of Abu Yasha.
Neither Ari nor Taha quite believed Ari's words. Ari was tired. He walked up to the Arab and put his hand on Taha's shoulder.
Please, Ari said. Help me.
I am an Arab,
Taha said.
You are a human being. You know right from wrong.
I am a dirty Arab.
It is you who thinks that of himself.
Are you going to tell me I am your brother?
You always have been, Ari said.
If I am your brother, then give me your Dana. Yes, that is right. Give her to me and let me take her to my bed. Let her bear my children.
Ari's fist shot out and crashed against Taha's jaw. The Arab was sent sprawling to his hands and knees. He sprang up and instinctively unsheathed the dagger from his waist sash and came at Ari. Ari stood rigidly, making no move to defend himself. Taha raised the knife, then froze and turned and threw it from him. It clattered over the stone floor.
What have I done?
Ari whispered. He walked toward Taha with an expression that begged forgiveness.
You have told me everything that I need to know. Get out of my house, Jew.
Chapter 4. A terrible turn had taken place at Flushing Meadow. Anticipating the necessity of armed intervention to back up partition, and fearing the Russian position as part of an international force, the United States announced its intention to abandon its stand for partition. The Yishuv launched a desperate campaign to change the American defeatist attitude. In the middle of these important maneuvers, Barak Ben Kanan received an urgent cable to report at once to France. Because of the urgency of the work at Flushing Meadow, Barak was puzzled by the order, but he left immediately by plane. He was met by two Yishuv agents. Barak had been called to take part in highly secret negotiations of a vital arms deal. The Yishuv calculated that with the turn of events at Flushing Meadow, arms were the most urgent immediate need, and Barak one of the most able men for such business. It was their friend, Jan Masaryk of Czechoslovakia, who provided the information on sources of weapons in a half-dozen European countries. After several weeks of confidential and ticklish parleying, The deals were closed. The problem now became getting the arms into Palestine, still under British blockade. The first step was to acquire an airplane large enough to haul the arms. In Vienna, an Aliyah Bet agent found an obsolete surplus American Liberator bomber, which was purchased under the name of Alpine Charter Flights Incorporated. Next, they had to find a crew, 6 men, 4 South African Jews and 2 American Jews who had flown during the war, were picked and sworn to secrecy. Finally, the most difficult task was to create a secret airfield in tiny Palestine undetected by the British. An abandoned British fighter plane base in the Yisrael Valley was selected. It lay in an all-Jewish area and offered the maximum chance of the liberators being able to get in and out again. Meanwhile, the assembly of the arms inside Europe was carried out with the same secrecy that hid the true identity of the Alpine Charter Flights Incorporated. It was a race against time. 2 weeks would be needed before the first load of arms could leave Europe. The question was whether or not it would be too late. So far, miraculously, not a single settlement had fallen, but the Jewish convoys were being ripped to pieces. Water lines to the Negev desert settlements had been cut. In some places, the settlers were subsisting on potato peelings and olives. The focal point of the struggle was Jerusalem, where the isolation and starvation tactics were beginning to pay off. The Bab el Wad from Tel Aviv was littered with the wreckage of burned-out trucks. Only occasional huge convoys, mounted at crippling cost of men and materiel, staved off disaster in Jerusalem. For the first time in the history of Jerusalem, the city was violated by artillery fire from Kawukji's irregulars. Kawukji, Safwat, and Kadar urgently needed a victory. The Palestine Arabs were becoming uneasy over the failure of Arab predictions of great victories. It was Kawukji, the self-styled generalissimo of the Muftis, forces of the Yarmouk, who decided to grab off the honor of capturing the first Jewish settlement. He picked his target carefully, having no wish to try a nut too tough to crack the first time out. Kawukji picked what he believed to be a soft spot. Tirat Tzvi, the castle of the Rabbi Tzvi, was elected for the distinction of being the first Jewish settlement to fall. The kibbutz of Tirat Tzvi was made up of Orthodox Jews, many of whom were concentration camp graduates. The kibbutz stood in the southern section of the Beit Sha'an Valley, located there purposely to neutralize an otherwise completely Arab area. South of the kibbutz was the triangle, the all-Arab area of Palestine. Within shooting distance stood the borders of Jordan. Slightly north, the hostile Arab city of Beit Sha'an completed the cutoff of the kibbutz. Tirat Tzvi was one of the Jewish outposts that guarded the Jordan Valley farther to the north. Kawukji was delighted with his choice of Tirat Tzvi. The religious Jews of the kibbutz would crumple before the first massed attack. The brigand assembled hundreds of Arabs at the Nablus base in the triangle and marched up for the attack. Kawukji announced his victory in advance. It was published even before he made an attack. When he did move his troops into position, the Arab women from Beit Sha'an came to the edge of the battlefield and waited with sacks and containers to rush up after the troops and plunder the kibbutz. The attack came with a cloudy dawn. The Jews had 167 men and women of fighting age on the battle line, in trenches, and behind rough barricades facing the Arab position. The children were hidden in the centermost building of the kibbutz. The defenders had no armament heavier than a single 2-inch mortar. A bugle blew. Arab Legion officers with drawn swords led the charge. The irregulars behind them poured over the open fields in a massed frontal assault calculated to overrun the kibbutz by sheer weight of numbers. The Jews waited until the Arab force was within 20 yards. Then on signal, they cut loose with a tremendous volley. Arabs went down like mown wheat. The impetus of the Arab charge carried forward a second, third, and fourth headlong wave. The Jews continued their disciplined fire, blasting each rush as the leader's feet touched kibbutz ground. The field was littered with Arab dead, and the wounded screamed, "We are brothers! Mercy in the name of Allah!" The rest scrambled back out of range and began a confused retreat. Kawukji had promised them easy victory and plunder. He had told them this bunch of Orthodox Jews would flee at the sight of them. They had not reckoned on such a fight. The Arab women on the outskirts of the battle began to flee, too. The Arab Legion officers herded the running irregulars together and stopped the retreat only by firing at them. The leaders reorganized their men for another rush at the kibbutz, but the irregulars' hearts were no longer in their effort. Inside Tirat Zvi, the Jews were in bad trouble. They did not have enough ammunition left to hold off another charge if Arabs came in strong and hard. Moreover, if the Arabs changed strategy and tried a slow attack with flanking movement, the Jews could not contain it. They hastily organized a desperation tactic. Most of the ammunition was given to 20 sharpshooters. The rest dropped back to the children's house and prepared for a last-ditch fight with bayonets, clubs, and bare hands. Through field glasses, they watched the Arabs' mass and saw that there were enough troops left to overrun the kibbutz. The Arabs came over the field more slowly this time, with some of the Legion officers behind the troops forcing them on at gunpoint. Suddenly, the heavens opened up in an unexpected downpour. Within minutes, the open field was turned into a deep and bogging mud. The Arab charge, instead of gaining momentum, began to wallow, just as the Canaanite chariots had done against Deborah. As the first Legion officers reached the kibbutz, the sharpshooters picked them off. Kawukji's noble forces of the Yarmouk had had enough for the day. Kawukji was in a rage over the Tirat Zvi debacle. He had to have a victory quickly to save face. This time he decided to go after big game. The road between Tel Aviv and Haifa was more important to the Yishuv from a purely strategic standpoint than the road to Jerusalem. If the Tel Aviv-Haifa line could be cut, the Arabs could sever the Jewish dispositions, splitting the Galilee away from the Sharon. There were Arab villages on the main highway which forced the Jews to use alternate interior roads to maintain transportation between the two cities. On one of the vital alternate roads was Kibbutz Mishmar Hayemek, the guard post of the valley. Mishmar Hayemek became Kawukji's goal in the ambitious move to separate Tel Aviv from Haifa. This time, Kawukji determined not to repeat the mistakes of Tirat Zvi. He massed more than 1,000 men and moved them into the hills surrounding the kibbutz, together with 10 75-millimeter mountain guns. With Mishmar Hayemek ringed, Kawukji opened a brutal artillery barrage. The Jews had one machine gun with which to answer back. After a day of the pounding, the British called a truce, entered the kibbutz, and advised the Jews to pull out. When they refused, the British left, washing their hands of the affair. Kawukji learned from the British that the Jews were relatively weak inside the kibbutz. What he did not know, because of his lack of an intelligence system, was that the Emek Valley was alive with men in training for the Haganah. During the second night, two entire battalions of Haganah, all armed with rifles, slipped into the kibbutz. On the third day, Kawukji mounted the attack. Instead of walking into a frightened and cowering kibbutz, he ran into two battalions of eagerly waiting and trained men. Kawukji's offense was smashed. He rallied his men and tried a slow, sustained move. It was equally unsuccessful. He mounted more attacks, but with each the irregulars showed less inclination to fight. They straggled forward half-heartedly and pulled back whenever resistance stiffened. Toward the end of the day, Kawukji lost control of his troops. They began to walk out of the battle area. Inside the kibbutz, the Jews witnessed the development and poured out after the Arabs. Here was a completely unexpected turn. The Arabs were so startled at the sight of Jews charging that they all fled, with the Haganah literally at their heels. The running fight surged back miles to Megiddo, site of 100 battles through the ages. Here, on the historic fighting ground of Armageddon, the Jews completely broke Kawukji's forces. The carnage stopped only when the British stepped in and forced a truce. The Jews had won their first real victory of the War of Liberation. In the Jerusalem corridor, the Hillman Brigade of the Palmach performed Titan's work to keep the road open. This gang of teenagers, with commanders in their 20s, patrolled the deep gorges and wilds of Judea, making fierce hit-and-run raids on Arab villages in conjunction with convoy runs. They frequently worked around the clock until they were numb with exhaustion. Yet they could always be goaded on to one more patrol, one more raid, one more hike through the fierce country.
"In this wadi, King David also lived as a guerrilla fighter."
The bloodshot eyes of the Palmach youngsters recorded fatigue as they roused to still another effort.
"Remember, you are fighting at the place where Samson was born. In this valley, David met Goliath. Here, Joshua made the sun stand still."
At night, the Bible was read to the exhausted warriors as a source of inspiration for the superhuman efforts the next day would call forth. Here, in Kadar's territory, the fighting was hard and constant, and the Arabs had confidence behind a strong leader. An enormous convoy mustered in Tel Aviv for another all-out effort to save Jerusalem. The Hillman Brigade's job was to take the Arab village of Kastel, built on a crusader fort dominating one of the main heights of the highway. The storming of Kastel became the first Jewish offensive action in the War of Liberation. The brigade made a sheer guts attack, crawling up the treacherous incline under cover of friendly darkness. They reached the peak of the Kastel bloodied and weary, but threw themselves into hand-to-hand combat and threw the Arabs out. Kastel lifted the flagging spirits of the Yishuv. Following the victory, the huge convoy from Tel Aviv battled every inch of the way through the Bab el-Wad, slogged on through to New Jerusalem, and again brought vital relief to the beleaguered Jews. Kawukji summoned Mohammed Qasi, the Hula commander of the irregulars, from Fort Esther to headquarters in Nablus. Kawukji was frantic for a victory. For months he had been writing communiques boasting of triumph after triumph. As the general of the Mufti, Kawukji had nourished the dream of commanding an Arab army that spread from the borders of Turkey to the Rock of Gibraltar. He blamed British intervention as the reason he had been unable to win a Jewish settlement. When the British pulled out of the Hula area, he had no alibi left. Kawukji kissed Mohammed Qasi on both cheeks in the accustomed style, and they spoke at great lengths of their glorious victories. Qasi told of how he had conquered Fort Esther, and Kawukji described how he had weakened Tirat Zvi and Mishmar Hayamek with brilliant probing tactics.
"I have received a message from His Holiness the Mufti in Damascus," Kawukji said. "On May 15th, the day after the British terminate the mandate, Haj Amin el-Husseini will make a triumphant return to Palestine."
"And what a magnificent day that shall be for all of Islam," Mohammed Qasi nodded. "His Holiness has selected Swat as his temporary capital until the Zionists are completely exterminated. Now that the dear friend of the Jews, Major Hawks, is gone from Swat, we will have it within a week.
I am delighted to hear such news. However,
Kawukji continued,
Svat will not be truly safe and fit for the return of His Holiness so long as a single Jew remains in the Hula Valley. They hold a dagger in our backs. We must erase them.
Muhammad Qasi turned slightly pale.
The Hula, I believe, is in your command, my brother. I want you to capture Gandafna at once. As soon as Gandafna falls, we will have the rest of the Hula Zionists by the throat.
Generalissimo, let me assure you that each and every one of my volunteers is a man filled with the courage of a lion, and is dedicated to the noble cause of crushing Zionism. They have all vowed to fight to the last drop of blood.
Good. They are costing us almost $1 a month in pay alone.
Qasi stroked his beard and held up his forefinger with its large, jeweled ring.
However, it is well known that Major Hawks left 3,000 rifles, 100 machine guns, and dozens of heavy mortars at Gandafna.
Kawuchi sprang to his feet.
You cringe before children?
I swear by Allah's beard that the Jews have sent in 1,000 Palmach reinforcements. I have seen them with my own eyes.
Kawukji slapped Muhammad Qasi twice across the face.
You will lay open Gandafna. You will level it to the ground, and you will wash your hands in their blood, or I will set your carcass out for the vultures.
Chapter 5 Muhammad Qasi's first move was to send 100 of his men into Abu Yesha. Immediately, some of the villagers went down to Kibbutz Ein Or to report the fact to Ari. Ari knew that the people of Abu Yesha were predominantly with the Jews. He waited for them to act. The Arabs of Abu Yesha resented the presence of the irregulars. They had been neighbors of the people of Yad El for decades. Their homes had been built by the Jews. They were not angry and had no desire to fight, and they looked to Taha, their Mukhtar, to rally them and eject Qasi's men. Taha kept a strange silence, speaking neither for nor against the coming of the irregulars. When the elders of Abu Yesha urged him to unite the people, Taha refused to discuss the matter. His silence sealed the fate of Abu Yesha, for the Fellahin were helpless without leadership. They quietly submitted to the occupation. Qasi was quick to capitalize on Taha's passive acquiescence. Day by day his men became bolder and more unruly as Taha continued his silence. The road to Gandafna was cut. There was anger in Abu Yesha, but it was no more than grumbling on an individual level. Then, 4 Abu Yesha Arabs were caught by the irregulars running food up to Gandafna. Qasi had them killed, decapitated, and their heads put on display in the village square as a warning. From that point on, Abu Yesha was completely subdued. Ari had guessed wrong. He had felt sure that the people of Abu Yesha would force Taha to take a stand, especially with the safety of Gandafna at stake. Their failure to act and the closing of the road put him in a terrible position. The road shut, Qasi's ponderous mountain guns began an around-the-clock shelling of Gandafna from Fort Esther. The Jews had trained for this sort of thing at Gandafna from the day the place was opened. Everyone knew his job. They switched onto emergency footing quickly and quietly. All children over the age of 10 were assigned to an active part in the village defense. The water tank had been sandbagged, and the power generators, medical supplies, arsenal, and food stores had been installed underground. Life went on as usual in the dank bunkers. School classes, dining, games, and all routine functions continued below the ground. Sleeping quarters were shelf-like bunks in dormitories built inside sections of 12-feet diameter concrete water pipes which had been sunk deeply into the earth and covered with yards of dirt and sandbags. Whenever the shelling outside stopped, the children and staff came out from the bunkers to play, stretch their cramped muscles, and to take care of the lawns and gardens. Within a week, the staff had made it seem that the whistling shells and explosions were merely another minor unpleasantness of daily living. Down at Ein Ohr Kibbutz, Ari faced the problem. All the settlements must depend on their own defense systems, but Gandafna held 600 children and stood in the most vulnerable place, there beneath Fort Esther. There was enough food for a month, and the water supply would be ample if the tank was not hit. Fuel would become a problem. It was extremely cold during the nights in the mountains, and Ari knew that Dr. Lieberman would rather freeze than cut down the precious trees for burning. Communications from Gandafna were maintained by blinker light to Yad El. The telephone line had been cut. The children's village was so completely cut off that the only way it could be reached was by a dangerous and grueling climb up the west face of the mountain, more than 2,000 feet, which had to be negotiated by night. The communication and supply problem, however, was not Ari's main worry. The fear of massacre was. He could not guess how long it would be until the armed might myth of Gandafna would be exploded. By shaking down his entire command, Ari was able to come up with a dozen Spanish rifles of late 1880 vintage, 23 homemade Sten guns, and an obsolete Hungarian anti-tank weapon with 5 rounds of ammunition. Zev Gilboa and 20 Palmach reinforcements were ordered to deliver the new equipment. Zev's patrol were to be human pack mules. The anti-tank gun had to be dismantled and carried in pieces. The patrol moved out under cover of dark, and through one entire night they climbed up the sheer west slope of the mountain. At one critical point they passed within a few feet of Abu Yesha's boundary, through a 300-yard draw which had to be negotiated by crawling a few inches at a time. They could see, hear, and smell Kasi's irregulars. The sight of Gandafna was a saddening one. Many of the buildings showed artillery hits, and the lovely center green had been chopped to pieces. The statue of Daphna had been knocked from its pedestal. Yet the morale of the children was amazingly high, and the security system was completely effective. Zev was amused by the sight of little Dr. Lieberman coming out to greet the patrol with a pistol strapped to his waist. Sighs of relief greeted the coming of the 20 Palmach reinforcements. Kasi continued the bombardment for 10 more days. The mountain guns knocked down the buildings one by one. Gandafna drew its first casualties when a shell exploded near the entrance of a shelter and killed 2 children. But Kawukji wanted action. Kasi tried 2 or 3 half-hearted probes. Each time his men were ambushed and killed. For Zev had extended Gandafna defenses to the very gates of Fort Esther. Palmach boys and girls hid out near both the fort and Abu Yesha to watch every Arab move. Meanwhile, a courier came to Ari from Haganah headquarters in Tel Aviv. Ari called his settlement commanders together at once. A high decision had been made in Tel Aviv regarding the children in border settlements. It was recommended that all children be moved into the Sharon Tel Aviv area close to the sea, where the situation was not so critical, and where every home, kibbutz, and moshav was ready to receive them. One could read between the lines. The situation had become so bad that the Haganah was obviously thinking of eventual evacuation of the children by sea to save them from massacre if the Arabs broke through. It was not an order. Each kibbutz and moshav had to make the decision for itself. On the one hand, the farmers would fight more fiercely with their children close by. On the other hand, massacre was a horrible specter to contemplate. The evacuation of the children was a doubly painful thing for these pioneers, for it became symbolic of further retreat. Most of them had fled from former horror to come to this place, and their farms were the last line of retreat. Beyond Palestine, there was no hope. Each settlement made its decision. Some of the older and longer established places simply refused to let their children go. Others vowed they would all stand and die together. They did not want their children to know the meaning of retreat. Others in the mountains, already isolated and undergoing hardships, managed to bring children out for removal. Gandafna was everyone's responsibility. Ari's spies reported that Kawukji was bringing unbearable pressure on Muhammad Kasi to make an assault on Gandafna. Food was getting low in the village, and fuel was all but gone. The water tank had sprung several leaks from near hits. The hardship of bunker life was wearing down the community, although there were no complaints. The commanders in the Hula Valley agreed that the younger children had to be taken out of Gandafna. The question was, how? A truce would involve a double danger. First, Kasi would never recognize it. Second, it would be a costly show of weakness to the Arab commander. If Ari tried a convoy through the roads or an outright attack on Abu Yesha, he would have to pull out and mass his entire Hula strength. Then he could be only half certain of success. It was not merely a matter of winning or losing a battle. To lose would lead to the death of the children. As so many times before, Ari was called upon to evolve a desperation measure to counter crushing odds. And because there was no choice, again he conceived a fantastic plan, this one more daring than anything he had ever tried in his life. After organizing the details of his scheme, Ari left David to mobilize a task force, and he set out for Gandafna. The climb up the mountainside was painful every inch of the way. His leg throbbed constantly and collapsed several times during the night. He was able to compensate for the handicap by his intimate knowledge of the route, for he had climbed it a dozen times as a boy. He reached Gandafna at dawn and immediately called a meeting of the section heads at the command post bunker. Zev, Yordana, Dr. Lieberman, and Kitty Fremont were among them.